This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and today we start with higher education. Boston is, in a lot of ways, a city of students, but the landscape of higher education in the U.S. is really in the middle of some dramatic changes. The Supreme Court is widely expected to alter affirmative action as it has stood. The Biden administration's attempt to forgive student debt is working its way through the courts. Small private colleges are closing. More people are asking what a college degree is worth. And for the first time in about a decade, the number of undergraduate degree earners in the U.S. has dipped. Now, at the same time, here in the Commonwealth, where education, higher ed, is a huge and important industry, we see a growing number of women leaders of color, including Black women, in top positions in higher ed, where their lived experience, their representation matters for how the universities get managed and solve the problems of the future. Today, we're going to engage in a deep conversation with three women leaders in higher education. Reverend Deborah Jackson is the Dean of the Business School at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. Lynn Perry Wooten is the president of Simmons College. The two of them are here in Studio 2. Lynn, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Deborah, great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us on the line, Jackie Jenkins Scott, the interim president of Roxbury Community College and the former president of Wheelock College. Jackie, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
So we're going to dive right in. Did I not say Simmons University? Did I say Simmons
College?
Yeah. No, it's a university.
Yes.
Sorry about that. Thanks for the correction from the team. So listen, I want to dive right in, but I want to start by asking you, I wanted to put the three of you in a room together and talk with you for a while. Do the three of you already know each other?
Yes, we do.
Yes. Well, I haven't met Dean Jackson yet.
You have. It's been a long time. It was a Founders Day celebration.
My goodness.
So we're doing a reunion.
Excellent. Yes. We have three sorority sisters in the room together.
What sorority?
Delta Sigma Theta sorority.
Fantastic. All right. So knowing that you have some connection before and now you find yourselves in, well, is it fair to say, Lynn, that you find yourselves in similar places now? Does that seem fair?
Yeah. I mean, you described it very well, is that this is a time where we're seeing a renaissance in leadership. We are seeing more women in higher education, more women of color. But at the same time, there are lots of challenges and opportunities.
Yeah. And Deborah, how long for you at Worcester Polytechnic?
Been just over 2 years.
Yeah. And Lynn, for you, it's been, two and a half?
Two and a half.
And Jackie, you've been about just a little under 2 years as the interim head of Roxbury Community College as well.
Just over a year. I was 12 years as president of Wheelock College.
Wow. So all kind of coming in at a time with intense disruption in higher education. And I want to start there. So Deborah, I'll turn to you first, Dean in the School of Business, Worcester Polytechnic Institute. What's kind of the biggest disruption that affects what you're trying to do every day in higher ed?
So right now, as I think about coming out of pandemic, the challenge of domestic learners. Domestic learners are wanting different things, particularly at the graduate level. This idea of coming and doing your four-year degree, then maybe having a couple of years of experience, then going to do a two-year master's degree program, that's completely disruptive. Students don't want that kind of learning. Online is huge for our population. But the challenge is that we have desires from international students who were completely shut out during the pandemic. That's starting to come back. But those are students who need in-person education. So that tension between the online of the domestic, which is a shrinking population, and the in-person of the international is a tough balance that we're working on.
Just to clarify, Deborah, the international students are a potentially growing student base for you?
Yes, they are.
All right. Lynn, how about you?
So many of you know Simmons is a women-centered college.
Yep.
So one of the challenge or opportunities is when we think about the peak of women colleges, there were 200. We are down to 29. Now, the Commonwealth is unusual that we have five, but still having a distinct product, a distinct way of delivering education at a women's college and meeting the challenges of the time are what we're thinking about. So do we have the right degree programs? How do we create graduate programs? How do you balance a portfolio of online versus on the ground? And really staying true to our mission, because we know that we see gender inequities. And the mission to achieve gender parity and to educate women for lifelong work is really what we're asking ourselves. How does that look post-pandemic? And how do we do it as a small college and thrive and survive are the questions we're asking.
Now, Jackie Jenkins Scott, we had you on recently. We were talking about the 50th anniversary of Roxbury Community College. We talked a little bit about the challenges for the community college system and RCC specifically. But just remind us again, in your mind, the biggest disruption you think RCC is dealing with right now.
And let me just quickly before I answer that question, and I think the issue of affordability is a challenge for all institutions, right, both mm-hmm. in public, and the ability for us to actually attract students and keep students because of cost is a huge challenge. And I know that from my colleagues at private institutions. I think that we have a great opportunity in the public sector right now. We have a governor who is committed to education and education access. And access to education has been a huge challenge, particularly for people of color. And we continue to face that in the public sector. We're really thrilled that Governor Healey is interested in making sure that, at least in the public sector, we begin to address the issue of affordability, so that students can retain, that they can start college and complete college. And certainly for so many students, complete college without owing hundreds of thousands, in some cases, literally, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars for some students if they're going on through the PhD, but thousands of dollars in debt. So that I think is a challenge for both our public and private institutions.
So it's really interesting in hearing the three of you lay these out. And right, and that is a handful of some even, I mean, there's more in the higher education right. landscape that's challenging than the ones that you're seeing is sort of primarily focused in your institutions. But even across that, we have a challenge of the value proposition of the education. We have a challenge of the technology and how you deliver the education. Right. Mm-hmm. We have a challenge of the fundamental existential identities of the institution and the identities of the young people they serve. I mean, that is big, big stuff.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
I think it keeps all three of us up at night.
Yes.
And what the future is going to hold and what we focus on when you're balancing the demands of what your internal constituents want. And you want each of us want our institutions to be excellent with what's happening, this whirlwind in our external environment.
So that's Lynn Perry Wooten of Simmons University there. Lynn, we talked to you when you came on.
Yes.
Right. I remember that conversation vividly. Now that you're in it a couple of years, were you right about where you were going to be thinking hardest and right. spending the most of your time?
And the last time we came on, we were like, oh, that's just a little virus over in Seattle, because we didn't know this pandemic was coming. It was a couple days.
It was like February.
Yes. Yeah. It was February. And post-pandemic, I think we're asking a lot of questions that Deborah and Jackie talked about, right? We have the more pressure to have multiple modes of delivery. Post-pandemic, all of us have to innovate. And then we have to address all the political things that you're going to ask us about. So when I came here in February, no, I did not think my world was going to be like this in February 20. Now I'm thinking more about financial models of higher ed, more so innovation and creating a university that can survive post-pandemic.
So Deborah, you were nodding through all of that. So let me just let you pick up the ball.
So it's exactly what my sisters have said, that we are all struggling with these same things. And so what we're trying to do at WPI writ large and the business school more specifically is try to weather that diversity of delivery, if you will. So having the in-person, on-the-ground course delivery, having the online learning, but then also partnering with industry and communities, because right. what we're starting to see more and more is that our corporate partners are demanding reskilling and upskilling in ways that is not a degree program. Don't tell me that it takes a year and a half to get some credential to claim mastery. I want something that is 2 weeks, a month. Work with us yeah. to develop that kind of content. So those are the things that we are looking at. How do we pivot so that we can deliver to the different constituencies in ways that are excellent and distinctive.
So Jackie Jenkins Scott, before I left Boston College, I was on the faculty of the Graduate School of Social Work at Boston College. Before I left, one of the last things I was engaged in was a panel where there was a woman there talking about gig workers. And one of the arguments she made is that the future of higher education would include a lifelong relationship where a gig worker would pay, you know, some kind of fee or retainer to a university for lifelong certification and education because their education needs and their need to prove I can do this, now I can do this, now I can do this was going to evolve over time. It seems like that is a place where community colleges might have some particular wisdom to offer. Is that a model you're thinking about at all? Or are the forces of survival so strong right now that it's hard to be thinking ahead like that?
Well, absolutely. You know, community colleges, the majority of our students are workers. They are in the workforce. And so we have to design programs that help meet their needs in their current jobs, but in the future jobs. And I know that Lynn will tell you and Dr. Jackson will tell you that we don't know what the future jobs will be. So our institutions have to be able to adapt. And it's so important for us to work closely with the workforce. And we know that, you know, in Massachusetts, particularly in Boston, you know, the medical and biotech fields are huge fields. And we have to make sure that those jobs are open to the entire breadth of the community, not just the PhD students, but the students who are working, who maybe do not have their entry-level bachelor's degree, and who are working towards those degrees. And so it is really critically important that we have the ability to adapt and to adjust to the workforce needs. Yeah. Almost all of our students are working students, and they're going to be lifelong learners in some cases. And we have to recognize that this business of graduating in 2 years or 4 years from our institutions will not work for all of our students. Just a very quick story. I was talking to some students in orientation a few weeks ago, and one young lady said to me, I asked them just to give us one quick word what they're thinking about. And she said she started at Roxbury Community College 40 years ago.
Wow.
Well, life happened. And she said, I want to finish my associate's degree, and I'm here to finish my associate's degree. That's a lifelong learner. And we have to be able to adjust to that, be able to make sure that we can meet the needs of the student who's coming back after 10 years, as well as the student who's graduating from high school, or in some cases, the student who's in high school taking college credits. And I think all of our institutions have some of these dual degree students right now.
So, Lynn, let me let you pick it up from there.
Yeah. There were two points I wanted to elaborate on. First, starting with Jackie, is that every college and university in this area are focusing on what I call the two L's, lifelong learning, but also educating people for their life work. What's their vocational calling? What do they want to do? And I joke, Jackie, when I'm walking in the halls, I tell my students, look, you're 21. You have at least 50 years to work because you're going to live to be 100. So you got to think about the course of what you need educationally and what you want to do with your career. Building upon Deborah's point is my research is on crisis leadership and industry disruption. And when we're at the point that higher ed is, you need what I call a mega community. And mega communities mean that the nonprofit sector, the corporate sector, and government has to come together to develop solutions. And then third, focusing on your point is that it's not either or. We have to pivot and adapt and innovate. We don't have any choice. You got to pivot and you got to adapt to the new world, and you have to come up with a whole new university.
Deborah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, and we're trying to live that out exactly because, for example, in Worcester has the vision of being a smart city where technology is embedded in the fabric of the city. Mm. And we want to make sure that as Worcester becomes that smart city, that everyone, regardless of socioeconomic background, is part of that and that they're not left out. So we're working with the city of Worcester, with other colleges and universities in Worcester, with with businesses in Worcester to do what we're calling a fab lab of the, focusing on fintech, AI, blockchain, the Internet of Things, to bring all of these technologies to bear to make a difference. And it's exactly the manifestation of what Lynn has said, that it's business, it's universities, it's our city governments that are coming together to do partnership in great ways that make sure that everyone gets a shot at the opportunities they want.
We're taking a deep dive into higher education with three women leaders I've been dying to talk to here in the area. Deborah Jackson, who is the dean of the Business School at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. Lynn Perry Wooten, who's the president of Simmons University. And Jackie Jenkins Scott, who's the interim president of Roxbury Community College and the former president of Wheelock College. We've talked a lot about sort of the mega trends in the industry right now, some of the challenges that are the biggest for your institutions. I'd like to get a little personal now, because one of the things that's fascinating about all three of you is both the traditional intersectionality of your identities. You are women of color emerging in leadership roles, but also each of you has really complex backgrounds that you bring into your leadership. So, and I'll start with you, Deborah Jackson. Many don't know you're a reverend, for example. You spent time as a pastor. So, given the challenges we've just laid out, what are the unique things that you as a woman leader with all of the, your intersecting identities are bringing to this mix that you value the most, that you that are, feel most relevant to you?
That is a great question. One of the things that I look at as a dean in a business school in the context of Worcester Polytechnic, which is traditionally an engineering school, but now computer science is our largest major, I look at all the things that I bring, and it feels very important and like it just fits together. So I am an engineer, both a software engineer and a manufacturing engineer by vocation and education. I am a business person with business majors, and as well as in the academy and in community for both for-profit and nonprofit organization. But as a pastor, and I would never let go of that moniker, I care about community. I care about people and demonstrating that what we do is important because it can make a difference for others, and business being a force for good. So all of that for me fits together very seamlessly and makes it possible for me to do this work, holding the space for my faculty and staff to do the great work that we do in community to make a difference in Worcester and beyond.
So Jackie Jenkins Scott, I'll turn to you next. You know, Wheelock College, RCC, but a history in social work and community engagement and the Dimmick Center. So lots of life experience for you too. What are you pulling on now, drawing on now most?
I think, you know, we draw on our life experiences, what we bring to each situation we encounter. And the beautiful thing is that the world is now open to, I want to believe that, to open to these differences. And we have an opportunity to be our authentic selves. There's so much been written about that, and Lynn can certainly talk about that. One exciting thing is next fall, I think there's going to be 9 or 10 women of color, African descent, who will be presidents or leaders of institutions of higher education in the Boston, Massachusetts, Rhode Island area. And if you look at the breadth of what those women will bring, some come traditionally from the academic specter, starting as faculty and moving up to presidents. Some are like me, who are, quote, non-traditional higher education leaders. So I think we bring our total self to the positions that we find ourselves in, and we bring the opportunity to share that, those values, those leadership traits, those skills, those experiences, all that we have, to make our institution stronger and better.
Lynn Perry Wooten.
Yeah. You know, it is, as Jackie said, wonderful to think about how many of my sisters will be presidents. And what I think each of us bring is, at our universities, a mission to ensure what I call experiential equity. That is, that every student or person who works at our university is able to show up and be their best self, It's to discover where they want to go, and it's to have a transformational experience. And being a woman of color and a Black woman, I think I got so far because people cared about me and they ensured that I had an experiential equity.
So I'm going to now put three big things on the table, right? So we've got the U.S. Supreme Court and what could happen with affirmative action. And I will say that when we covered it here, when the court was looking at the case, pretty much every expert that we talked to here on Radio Boston said, no, they're not going to uphold it, right? They're going to reverse mm-hmm. affirmative action. We have the battle going on over student loan relief. And Jackie Jenkins Scott, you know, you, for example, talked about affordability as maybe one of the most important issues that Roxbury Community College is facing. And then we also have questions of identity. I mean, Wellesley, right, just had the students vote that they were in support of transgender men being students at the university itself went a different way. Lynn, you talk about historically being a women's college. Right. So in these existential moments, let me just start there. What are you most watching? And Lynn, I'll come right back to you.
You know, those three things are really calling us to say the status quo has to change. So starting with affirmative action, right? In every crisis, there's an opportunity. The writing's on the wall, what's going to happen. But each of us who lead universities, so what if the federal law goes away? What can we do in our own powers to ensure that we open doors for people from underrepresented and under-resourced backgrounds? We have policies that not only open the doors, but make sure they succeed. So if governments fail us, then we have to take the ownership. With regards to, and Jackie's hinted on this, we have a system that's failing, and we need to revamp and think about financial aid for public and private and how we make college affordable. That's going to require philanthropy, and that's going to require more government funding. But, you know, I think about my own college. It was probably under $5,000 back in 84. Inflation has hit us, the cost and the services. And then it goes back to experiential equity again and gender inclusion. This generation has redefined what they think about as gender equity, and we have to design the policies to make sure people feel like they belong, but align them with our mission.
How about you, Deborah Jackson? How are you thinking about it?
It is distressing, to say the least, to think about the changes that are happening in affirmative action. We are acting as a society like these matters have been solved, and that we don't need this kind of equity or a boost. And there are always people who are left behind, and we don't have mechanisms to ensure that people are able to catch up. One of the things that I did, I introduced a scholarship program, and we called it my diversity, the Dean's Diversity Scholarship. And we had to kind of be very creative in the way that we structured it. And we talked about, please share with us as the essay prompt your experience of marginalization and how it has impacted you and committed you to ensuring diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. So that has been how we've had to change. And it's just as Lynn says, if the superstructures fail us, what can we do in our own context to ensure that we're promoting and helping to make the experience of those who have been under-resourced or underrepresented, that they could access our universities and get what they need?
We're taking stock of higher ed with Deborah Jackson of the Worcester Polytechnic Institute, Lynn Perry Wooten of Simmons University, and Jackie Jenkins Scott of Roxbury Community College. Jackie, I'll turn to you now. You know, I laid out those three big existential questions. Let me just have you pick up the thread.
You know, I think this is, for Black folks, we have always had to battle these challenges of, you know, will government do the right thing? And we know that nine times out of 10, it hasn't turned out the way we've wanted. But I see this as a real opportunity for us to look at pathways for people to gain access to the educational experience they want and they need. And it's a real opportunity for community colleges, because as we reevaluate the cost of that education, there are very creative ways we can continue to work together. You know, you can come to a community college, get started, and end up at Simmons or end up at Worcester Polytech and cut the cost of what it's going to take for you to get your final, where you want to end up finally. Or you can come back later on to our institutions, to any of our institutions as we're thinking about lifelong learning. So I see all of these challenges as opportunities, opportunities for us to innovate, to collaborate, to create, and to work together to just make access available. Because we know at the end of the day, education is the key. Education is the key to opportunity. It's the key to, you know, prosperity and a key to, you know, so many opportunities in life. So I think our job as leaders are to make sure we make those opportunities available to as many as we possibly can. And I think it's a real opportunity now for us to look at the public and private sector and how we work together to make access more available to a larger group of students and to the public in general.
Lynn. Yeah, you know, Jackie, it's a call to action, as we said. You know, government's going to change the policy, but what are those partnerships? How are corporations stepping in to help educate people who they want to employ? How are they helping to fund colleges? The role of foundations. All of them have to step up to help us to kind of make this great society.
Deborah.
I was going to say I'm working with a partner that won't share the name, but you talked about gig economies a few minutes ago. And we've said we could create gig economies with technologies. So robotics, for example, where you can create the opportunities for people to learn how to operate, to maintain robots, cobots in certain industries and sectors. Those could be the good jobs of the future that would be perfect for this generation who are digital natives. So how do we work with corporations to operationalize that vision and then push that vision to the students? They might be high school students. They might be some individuals who have a couple of years of college, but aren't going or aren't interested in the 2-year or 4-year degree. There are opportunities, but the partnerships, as Lynn says, are important. And then the lifelong learning that can continue to be that undergirding, as Jackie has noted, that's an opportunity for us.
You know, likewise, there was an article in the Boston Globe yesterday that said about 1/5 of doctors or healthcare providers are leaving the industry. So when you think about all of our colleges, hospitals should be partnering with us to have nurses, paraprofessionals, physicians, physician assistants to manage the shortage. This is another example where we need public-private partnerships.
So I have one quick lightning round question for the three of you because we have about 60 seconds left. Jackie, I'll start with you. Overall, are you feeling like AI and ChatGPT, those kinds of things, good thing, bad thing?
Oh, questionable.
Okay, and Lynn?
There's always opportunity. We can make good and we can also do bad.
Lynn, how about you?
Right, I think we can make it good.
Okay, and Deborah?
Likewise, I think we can make it good.
All right, and last thing, 30 seconds, just a sentence from each of you. Thing you're most excited to teach next in your university?
Yeah. How women continue to shatter the glass ceiling.
And Deborah?
How business and technology make a difference in the world.
And Jackie Jenkins Scott?
How you can create your own pathway.
All right. Really satisfying conversation. Thank you. I know you're busy. Appreciate all of you. Jackie Jenkins Scott is the interim president at Roxbury Community College. Lynn Perry Wooten is the president of Simmons University. And Deborah Jackson is the dean of the business school at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thank you.
13 women in the Boston area were killed in the early 1960s. Before the public knew about serial killers, these murders terrorized the city and captured the imagination of the country. The murderer, dubbed the Boston Strangler. At the time, law enforcement had no protocol for catching a serial killer, and the media didn't have a lot of interest in covering a story about regular women victims until two women reporters at the Record American got on the case. Eventually, the Boston Strangler murders became not only subject of newspapers, but books and even a movie in 1968. And now, a half century later, the Boston Strangler comes to the screen again. Out today on Hulu and filmed in Boston, the Boston Strangler follows two female journalists who made the name Boston Strangler famous. The film's writer and director, Matt Ruskin, grew up in Watertown, and Chris Cooper, who plays the editor of the Record American, is a local too. They joined us earlier this week to talk about this latest film set in Boston, and I started by asking them the first time they heard about the Boston Strangler.
I mean, you know, I've heard about the Boston Strangler my whole life, but just in a very abstract sense. I really knew nothing about the case until I started reading about it a few years ago.
And what started you on that path?
So I had just finished this film, Crown Heights, and I was looking for something new to write about. And I started reading all the books that I could find about the Boston Strangler. I listened to an incredible podcast called Stranglers and discovered this incredibly layered murder mystery at the heart of the story. And I had seen the 1968 Tony Curtis film and felt like there was a whole lot of new ground to cover. But it wasn't until I came across these reporters, Loretta McLaughlin and Gene Cole, who were among the first reporters to break the story and who actually named the Boston Strangler during the course of their reporting, that I felt like I was really inspired to pursue making a film.
And Chris, you grew up in Kansas City. You've been a Massachusetts resident for a while now, though. Do you remember when you first became aware of the Boston Strangler?
Certainly. I mean, I was a little boy, but make a long story short, my grandmother always wanted to be a news writer, and she got into it after her husband stroked out and became less demanding. She got a little freedom, but she was a great follower of the Truman Capote in Cold Blood. And she followed a lot of different murders, and this was kind of in the same period. So she kept me very aware of it.
So quite young, actually.
Yeah. Oh, I was in grade school, for
sure. Interesting. All right, so here's what's on my mind, having watched the film. The Boston Strangler is in the title. You've talked, Matt, about, you know, it's a deep, complicated crime thriller. But as a good film ought to be, it feels to me like this movie is about a lot of things, with the Boston Strangler as the heart and the device. But depending on where you sit when you watch it, it could be about a lot of different things. It could be about local news. It could be about feminism. It could be about women working. It could be about policing. Where do you come at it, Matt? What's it about to you?
So, listen, I love true crime. I consider myself, you know, a true crime audience member, but I didn't set out to make a serial killer movie. I was really taken with the murder mystery, with all the different layers to this story. And like you said, it's about so many things. And I think that is one of the things that appealed to me, that in many ways, it's as much about the changing identity of the city at the time. But it wasn't until I discovered the story of these two journalists, Loretta McLaughlin and Gene Cole, that I felt really like there was a really compelling way to revisit this case, because, you know, they were very much trailblazers in their field, and they did a lot of really important reporting at a time when, you know, the police department was coming up short.
So let's dive into that a little bit. And I'm actually going to play a little sound here. Keira Knightley, who plays Loretta McLaughlin, talking to your character, Chris Cooper, Jack McClain, who's the editor at the Reporter American. So here's a little bit of that sound.
Three women were strangled over the last 2 weeks.
I don't see the interest. These are the nobodies.
Who do you think our readers are? And that's just it. Why would anybody go around killing three nobody women?
Well, how do you plan to find that out?
Let me profile the victims. See if there's any connection.
Kid, you're not covering a homicide.
Why not?
Because you don't have any experience covering homicides.
Well, how am I supposed to get any experience if you won't give me a shot?
I said Reporter American. I meant Record American. So, Chris Cooper, two things there. One, maybe because I'm in local news, this movie also felt to me like a little bit of a love story about the power of local news, local journalists who care about their community. And you talked in some interviews for the film about the experience that these women had trying to report this story. Do you still read the newspaper? Do you see the local news angle in this, or is this a Rorschach test for me because it's what I do.
No. We're strong subscribers to both the Globe and New York Times. We get the New York Times Sunday paper anymore. But I just want to add, I touched base with people are very familiar with Eileen McNamara. She was a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. And she and Loretta actually was Eileen's mentor. She worked at the Globe, and she was educated at the Columbia Journalism School. So she gave me really firsthand reports of her experience, which hadn't really improved until about in the newsroom until around the 80s. And she's filled me with all kinds of stories of how rude and dismissive these men were in the newsroom. So I think, so much of the story is really timely on these women fighting to, report hard, tough news.
It's funny that you say that, and we're speaking with Chris Cooper and Matt Ruskin on the new Hulu film, The Boston Strangler. In watching the film, I found myself thinking, last year I did a WBUR City Space event with Eileen McNamara from the Boston Globe and with Margaret Sullivan, who had been at the New York Times, the Washington Post, but started at the Buffalo News. And so much of the way I was seeing these two women reporters made me think of the stories that Margaret Sullivan and Eileen McNamara told. It's interesting to see that influence was real, Chris, in the film. Matt Ruskin, I'll turn to you. What kind of research did you do to write those voices, right? I mean, you are writing these women in a lived experience at another time in a way that is in their guts. So what kind of research did you do to get yourself there?
So I was lucky enough to be able to talk to both Loretta and Jean's kids to get a sense of who these women were, both as people and as journalists. And there's an enormous archive of the Record American newspaper that's been digitized. So I was able to go back and read all of the articles that they had written about the Boston Strangler. And I was able to get a sense of their voice as journalists, some of which actually made the film. I was able to pull quotes from some of their stories. And then, like Chris did, I spoke with people whose careers overlapped with Loretta and Jean's, really just to get a sense of who they were and how they approached their work.
So I want to bring a little more voice in here. This is Keira Knightley, again, as Loretta McLaughlin, in the film talking to her husband, James McLaughlin, who is played by Morgan Spector.
So why haven't you asked me to stay home?
Because I know better.
No, I'm serious. Why not?
Because you'd be miserable.
Well, so what? Our lives would be easier. Kids would be better off.
Says who?
Your sister. My mother, the neighbor.
What the hell do they know? You'd drive so mad if you were sitting around here all day.
Matt, you talked to the kids. Were they glad their mom worked? Were they glad she did this work?
Yeah, they all took a lot of pride in what she did. And to them, it was normal, even if she was the only, mother on the street who had a full-time job. To them, it was what they were used to, and they were they found it exciting that she was so tied to current events, and they take a lot of pride in the work that she did.
Chris Cooper, I'll turn back to you. One of the other things, we're having this conversation as part of our Set in Boston series, where we look at films that are either set in or made about Boston, and you've been in a few, and you live in Boston. What did you learn about the city that you didn't know from making this film?
I really took Jack McClane as he was presented in the script. And by that, I mean, I was very interested in the politics of the newsroom. Mm. And even the piece that you played where he says, well, these women that were killed, they're nobodies. And Loretta says, no, they're your readers. Good, strong, working class people I wasn't, as Jack wasn't, I wasn't so interested in the murders. I as an, you know, as an actor, I was looking for what's going on in the newsroom. What's the hierarchy? What's the politics? That was my, you know, that's what I look for to build the character.
And how about you, Matt? I mean, you grew up in Watertown, grew up in the area. A lot of the film was filmed in Boston South End, for example. Did you discover, you made reference earlier in our conversation to sort of reflecting a city that was changing at the time. What did you learn about Boston in telling this story?
Yeah, you know, it was amazing that everybody I talked to of a certain generation who had been around all had such vivid memories of the Boston Strangler case. It really permeated every corner of the city, whether, you know, people knew somebody who thought they had a run-in with the Boston Strangler, or, you know, a story of a young kid wanting to make sure his mom would get home from work safe. So it was amazing to hear the grip that this story had over the city and anecdotes that, you know, the perception was people didn't used to lock their doors in Boston before the Boston Strangler murders. And then, you know, just being able to come back here and film was really an incredible experience. You mentioned the South End, some of those old brownstones, those neighborhoods haven't changed in well over 100 years. And so when you line those streets with old cars, it really, you know, the neighborhood just transformed, and it was amazing to see.
So there are two other things that I want to touch on. And Chris Cooper, you talking about the politics of the newsroom and wanting to delve into that. One of the other things that is striking in this story is the relationship between a newsroom, between journalists and the Boston police, who don't look great in this film. But there is this relationship between Loretta McLaughlin and a Detective Conley, who's played by Alessandro Nivola. And I want to play a little bit of sound of him, and, you know, as a character speaking to Loretta.
You know how many people I've gone down the rabbit hole with? It's a dead end every time with this case. You get your teeth into something and then your bottom falls out at 3 a.m. and you got nothing. Well, I'm making myself crazy. He's out there somewhere. Laughing at us.
And so the police, Matt, become kind of their own character. It's almost like he's a representative character of the Boston police force. And they have a complicated role to play in this story, Matt Ruskin.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I think Alessandro's a composite character to really represent a handful of the detectives who were much more forward-thinking than the rest of the department. You know, this was at a time, this was a decade before the term serial killer even came into existence. The field of criminology was still in its infancy. And people like Loretta and Jean were out talking to psychiatrists, trying to, you know, profile this possible culprit. And there were a handful of detectives who were really interested in what they were doing and were open to talking to them. Whereas I think a number of them were very dismissive of these, you know, quote unquote, girl reporters.
So, fun question for you, Chris Cooper. Alessandro Nivola talked about growing up in Boston himself, by the way, but having to really work on authenticity and spending a lot of time with officers, doing a lot of research. Did he get the feel right? Did he get the accent right in your mind?
Oh, absolutely. I knew, you know, Matt grew up, you know, he grew up here. He got the cadence. He got it beautifully. Beautifully. He grew up very close to where my wife, Marianne, grew up in around Newton and Watertown. I think he did a beautiful job in uncovering the rhythms and his locations are, it's like a step back in time. I think he's done a beautiful job.
How does it feel to hear that, Matt?
A little bit surreal. Chris is a hero of mine.
That's great. All right. So one last question. And this, I had this question, and then our producer, Bart Tachi, found some sound today that really underscores it. And this is Keira Knightley talking about the film and some of the film material and what appealed to her about the story?
It's such a complicated case. The reason I wanted to do it was I thought it was fascinating that it was two women who highlighted the case in the first place, and then the problems within the reporting of it and the police work that went into it. So I felt like it was a very important story to tell. I felt like it really highlighted the importance of female investigative journalists, and it really highlighted the importance of having women in positions of power as far as storytelling went.
You know, Matt, with that ringing in my ear and Chris's, you know, reiterating his line from the movie about, no, these are your readers, right? The women who were killed aren't nobodies, they're your readers. Do you think that these women journalists had a different empathy and a different eye and a different attention? Would this story have gotten reported the same way from the Record American if it hadn't been two women journalists?
No, you're absolutely right. Being relatively young women themselves, I think they identified with the victims in a way that the other reporters didn't. And I think they were able to, you know, create a more intimate portrait of many of these victims because they looked at it differently. There was a great anecdote that they got to know who these women were so well. They would say, oh, so-and-so would never answer the door to a stranger. It must have been someone she knew because they really, you know, went out of their way to get a sense of who these women really were.
The film is The Boston Strangler, out March 17th on Hulu. Matt Ruskin is writer and director. Chris Cooper acts in the film. I want to thank you both for being with us. Fascinating conversation. Thanks for doing Set in Boston.
Thanks for having us. Enjoyed it.
Thanks very much.
Now, before we go, on Monday, we're going to talk about live music in Greater Boston and beyond and what's next for the industry. We want to hear from you. Have you seen some live music recently? What excited you about it? What do you think the future is of live performance in Greater Boston, both for musicians and for the audience? What do you want to see more of, less of? Tell us. You can share all these thoughts by joining our text club. To get started, you text the word BOSTON to 617-766-0382. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Dearing. Thanks for listening. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.